Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Steve Austin Show. I'm coming to you from the mean streets of Los Angeles, California today. I'm on my day off before I head back to the set of Broken Skull Challenge for another group of badass contestants and another week of filming. But before we get rolling today, you need to get to the App Store or Google Play and download the new Podcast One app. You ain't never seen a podcast app like this before. You can do all the normal stuff like create playlists of your favorite shows and episodes, but here's what makes the new Podcast One app a must-have. You can watch over 1,000 360 virtual reality videos of your favorite podcast. And with virtual reality, it's like you're right there in the room with them. So get to the App Store or Google Play and download the new app now. All right, Phil Kogan's back on the show today. And this time we're talking about The Amazing Race, how he got involved, and what it really takes to shoot a competition race around the world. He's got more incredible stories, and he's also going to fill us in on the new show he's doing for the Smithsonian Channel. It's called Flying High. And I bet you didn't know this about Phil. He was also one of the first people to ever bungee jump off a bridge. And he set a Guinness Book of World Records for bungee jumping. And we're going to talk a little bit more about La Ride, the documentary that Phil made about the 1928 Tour de France. Him and his friend Ben rode a 3,300-mile course and filmed it all. And today, Phil talks about the toll that ride took not only on him physically, but also mentally. He experienced hallucinations on the road, and he's going to fill us in. And if you haven't seen La Ride yet, you got to check it out. It's awesome. You can see it on demand at PhilKoganLaRide.com. All right, man, before we get to Phil, I'll tell you what. Holy smokes, we come out of gates on Broken Skull Challenge, and man, it was on. These competitors that came out this year so far have been just absolutely stellar. Everybody's kicking ass. We got new challenges, got a new Skull Buster, got all kinds of badass stuff. The weather has been premier. So far, so good. It's hot out there, ain't no doubt about that. It's hot out there, and man, I live out there on set. And I tell you what, man, I got a Traeger grill, a pellet grill. I told you guys I was going to get one. And the other day I busted that thing out, and it's the first time I'd ever used it. I've been over to my brother-in-law's house in Reno when he used his, but I ain't never used one myself. Man, I just took four regular chicken breasts straight out of the damn pack, put some chicken rub on them, put them on that grill. When it was about 200, I heated it up to about 360. And then right when they'd been going for about, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes, I stuck in that thermometer gimmick that you stick in meat to get the internal temperature. Man, I ain't never used one of those before in my life. You talk about cool. Man, I pulled those chicken breasts off. I think I got the internal temperature right at about 155 to 160. I think on the computer, they'll tell you about 165, but I wanted to let it rest, so that was going to kind of cook it through. God dang, man. I didn't do nothing to those chicken breasts other than rub chicken rub on them and then put them on a Traeger grill, set it and forget it, hit that damn thermometer in there, and man, it was awesome. So I'm headed back out today, about to get my Ford Bronco, and then I'm going to load all my stuff up, head out there. I'm going to cook my dinner tonight, which is going to be a piece of salmon, and then I'm going to cook my two lunch meals tomorrow, which is going to be chicken breast. And it's making it pretty damn easy for me. I was real impressed with that thing. It's no muss, no fuss, and everything's turning out good. So shout out. That damn Traeger grill is awesome. Anyway, before I continue on, I want to say thank you very much to everybody for sending me emails and all the tweets that you sent on Twitter. When I dropped the news last week that we had to put Hershey down, man, I must have got a couple thousand tweets and a couple hundred emails of people saying, hey, man, sorry for your loss, my condolences and all that. And many people have been in the same shoes I've been in. And I tell you what, it was rough going back to work, but you know, you can't stop life. You just got to keep going. But I sure appreciate all the emails, all the tweets. A lot of people sent pictures of their dogs. I was looking at all the stuff. And I tell you what, my wife got me a framed picture of Hershey, and I took her collar back out there to the Broken Skull Challenge compound. So she's out there with me in spirit while I film the show. And I sure appreciate, once again, all the thoughts, all the emails, all the tweets. I tell you what, that was an awesome dog, and I appreciate the support. And anybody out there, man, if you got your dog, your cat, your turtle, pick it up and give it a hug. Man, they're man's best friend. And I tell you what, Mula and Callie are really starting to bond even closer than they were before. And it was interesting watching them go through the grieving process because they knew something was wrong. And they know that Hershey's gone. And so it took a while. It took a few days for them to adjust and kind of fall into a role. And I think they're still kind of trying to fall into a rhythm because Hershey was the alpha female. She was the veteran. And they kind of followed her lead. And, man, they'd play like banshees, but with her absence in the house, you know, they didn't really know where to the crap or wind their watch. So they're starting to get dialed in. My wife's still selling a little bit. Again, that dog was a big part of our life, and I will digress, and I'll get back to the task at hand. But many thanks for all you people that sent in your thoughts. And some people say, hey, man, it's just a dog. Man, I ain't just a dog. That was Hershey the Wonder Dog. That damn dog was my best friend. I miss her. But we got to go on down the road, and we got to keep on doing what we're doing, and that's it. Man, I tell you what, I'm looking forward to finishing Broken Skull Challenge here in the next 4 weeks. We got another 4 weeks of filming to go, and then I'm heading down to Nevada to do some scouting with my brother-in-law up there. And hell, I guess it's going to be the Sierra Nevada mountain range. Whatever that big country is up there, we might head over to a different mountain range and get ready for my mule deer hunt. I'm looking forward to getting one of my mules out there and riding on that I'm looking forward to getting one of my mules out there and ride on all that rocky terrain. It's going to be interesting because I've been used to riding the Broken Skull Ranch out there in South Texas, man. We got roads and senderos, and it's pretty smooth terrain. It's very unforgiving. There's a lot of thorns. There's a lot of brush. I mean, a lot of cactus, but it's not like that country up there. Mountainous, rocky, rough. So it's going to be different, and I'm looking forward to getting up there. That's about all that's going on with me right now. I mean, there's a lot more stuff going on, but I'm going to get back into finishing this open to get to part two with Phil Kogan because I got to pack all my stuff and get out there to the compound, cook chicken, cook dinner. My lunch is for tomorrow. Get settled in, go over the challenges. Got a new group of competitors rolling in. I want to make sure my Kawasaki mule's gassed up. I got to charge the battery on my Ram Charger. We have to jump start that thing every time we start it because it's been in storage since last season. So I need to go put a charge on that Ram Charger. I tell you what, I took my bow out there and I took a target out there and I thought I was going to have time to shoot. And I ain't got a chance to bust out my bow one single time because I'm too busy. I also have my Kawasaki dirt bike out there, and I got a little gimmick scooter. And I took two batteries out there to put in those because I figured, hey, man, I'll get out there and ride my dirt bike. I ain't had time to ride my dirt bike. I haven't even had time to put the batteries in the dirt bike or the scooter. So we're busy as hell, I'm busy as hell, and I want to get into part two of Phil Kogan. Let me give big ups to one of the sponsors who let me do this podcast for you twice a week for free, and that's Geico. I know everybody's got a to-do list. Drop off the dry cleaning, pick up some milk. Here's an idea for you. Let's add, save hundreds of dollars on car insurance. And the good thing is, you don't have to drop off or pick up anything. All you have to do is go to Geico.com. And in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. Extra money in your pocket? It just may be the most rewarding to-do you do today.
Have you heard Spike's Car Radio? It's comedian, actor, writer Spike Ferriston sitting on the porch in Malibu talking with some cool people about cool cars and life in general.
My first guest is Jerry Seinfeld. He's right here. He was all right. Don't try to hug him.
Chris Hardwick.
I could feel everything on the road. I mean, it was basically like, it was like unprotected sex for driving.
Jeremy Piven.
You know what? I think you and Jerry are spiritually tied to cars, and I respect it and I love it, but I don't quite get it yet, but I want to get it.
Download new episodes of Spike's Car Radio every Wednesday on the Podcast One app, or save time and subscribe now at Apple Podcasts or at PodcastOne.com.
The Steve Austin Show. The Steve Austin Show.
I'm rolling sound on part two of Phil Kogan, and before we talk about the amazing race, I got a couple more questions about the documentary, La Ride. There's one point where you guys are going through some extreme heat. How did your body deal with that? Because that looked like pure hell.
It was hell. It was 110 degrees where we were. There was no wind. In the south of France there in the summer, at the time that we were there, there was a heat wave. You can't drink enough. You can't get enough in. You're just drenched, this humidity. I'm not a great athlete in the super hot. I don't, you know, some people really think they actually function quite well. I don't operate that well. Some people are more suited. I'm not a, I really struggle in the heat. When it gets really crazy and there's that maximum exertion and you're just really pushing, I find that tough.
What was worse, the heat or the climb and the altitudes with the lack of oxygen?
I mean, I hallucinated, and Ben and I, we both really lost it a couple of times where we lost track of time. I think it got to the point where some of those climbs in the middle of the night, when you've been riding for 23 hours, there's a part of your brain that says never quit. And then, in a way, I think it's easier when you're so out of it that you've already programmed your brain to say, I'm never going to quit. I mean, both of us, we would have fallen on the ground before we quit. We were not going to quit.
Right.
And that's why it was so important to have Ben with me, because if I'd had somebody who spat the dummy, as we say in New Zealand, and just said, oh, man, I can't do this, I can't take this, that would have messed with my head too. I needed to know that we were suffering together. Or it's not that I so much needed to know. It really helped to have somebody who I knew was he was in. He was all in. He was all in with me, and neither one of us would have let each other quit.
What about the time? I guess it was one of the nights. It might have been the 23-hour shift that y'all pulled. And a couple of times because of delays. It was really interesting because the one guy that y'all rode with, I can't remember his guy.
Emil.
Oh, he was wonderful.
Emil, yeah.
Holy smokes, he suggested to leave at midnight because then you'll arrive there and still be daylight. But the crew wouldn't have it, so you had to leave, in the morning?
Yeah.
And sure enough, he bailed out on that
about 10 o'clock next night.
Yeah, and so nonetheless, there you guys are riding in pitch dark.
Yeah, that stage, so we were preparing ourselves for the death stage, which I believe is 209 miles and over 20,000 vertical feet of climbing. We knew this thing was coming, and we knew that in 1928, 100 riders had, there were only 100 riders out of 168 that started in Paris. This was the start of stage 9. So we knew it was going to be tough. We also knew that in 1928, of the 100 riders that started stage 9, the death stage, 25 guys dropped out in that one stage.
Right.
So we were psyching ourselves up for it. But we thought there was a rest day the day before. On stage 8, we thought there was a rest day. And then we found out, no, there was no rest day. So we didn't get into the hotel before the death stage. We didn't get into the hotel until about 9 o'clock at night, having ridden this long, long ride of 183 miles or something. We were tapped. And so Emil comes, we meet with him, and he shows us the schedule. And I guess we just hadn't done the calculations. Like, we didn't realize how far it was, but he knew these roads. So at 10 o'clock at night, he shows us the schedule, and he goes, Phil, in 1928, they started at midnight. They rode through the night, all through the next day, and they finished before dark. 18 and a half hours later, you need to leave at midnight. And I said, we just finished 2 hours ago. If you think that I can ask my mom and dad, who are in their 70s, Scott and this crew and us to now go out to the starting line at midnight and start riding again, you are out of your mind. I will have a mutiny. So we went to bed at around midnight. By the time we wrapped up, because don't forget, we're shooting a movie. We've got to digitize all the material. My mom's doing all the bottles up until the middle of the night, preparing the nutrition and everything for the next day. We left at 4, so we got 4 hours sleep that night. We were out on location at 4:30 in the morning. We rolled out just before 5. We were still riding at 10 p.m. the next night, and we realized we still had 3 more mountains to climb. And this guy, Emil, this French rider who so graciously helped us, he was like, I'm out, like 10 o'clock. So we'd ridden from 5. So what is that? Five? That's 15 hours he put in with us. And he was like, I'm done.
Yeah.
Guy was 65 years old. 65. Ripped. I mean, you saw his legs. Yeah. What an inspiration. Turned up on a 1928 bike that was the same bike that the winner of that stage won. Nicholas Franz, was it? No, Nicholas Franz won the tour. Oh, Victor Fontaine. Victor Fontaine was the rider who won in that stage in 1928. He turns up in the same outfit that the guy wore, an original outfit, plus the original bicycle. And that was one of the best moments on the whole ride. And how strong is that 65-year-old guy, right? I mean, you want to talk about tough. Woo.
What does your wife say to you? I know she's in television film business as well. What does she say to you when both you and Ben are going through these hallucinations and you're about to lose your mind?
I don't remember. I don't remember.
She ever try to talk you down or say, hey, man?
No, no, no. Not my wife. My wife is a champion bike rider. She's a state champion, amazing sprinter, second.
So tell me about the hallucinations then.
Well, the thing about it is what's weird is you just lose track of all time. So
I thought Ben was going to ride off the mountain.
Yeah. We were talking to each other. What was interesting was going back and looking at the tapes, because I couldn't remember certain parts of it, and neither could Ben. But I remember the lines, and we were moving super slow up the hill. It's in the middle of the night. The lines are going by, you know, 5-6 miles an hour. That's about all we could manage going up these hills, up these mountains. And I remember the lines, and I had convinced myself that the Peloton from 1928 was on the road, and that any moment when we came around a corner, they were going to be there. I was so convinced that they were there, that we had paid enough penance, if you like, that they were going to reveal themselves, that they were going to, like ghost riders, are going to be on the road or something. But the funny thing was, at one point, I see these giant sperm on the road.
I saw
like
those.
Massive sperm. I was like, man, I must be out of it. Like, what the hell? So the next morning, I said to Ben, I said, man, do you remember? He goes, I don't remember any. I said, do you remember the sperm on the road? He goes, dude. He says, I know I was out of it, but there was no sperm on the road. I said, Ben, I'm telling you, I saw sperm on the road. He goes, there's no sperm on the road. So I was like, oh, well, I guess I must have been seeing things. And months later, I went back to shoot some aerials. And we're flying up the Tourmalet. It's the most famous mountain stage in the Tour de France in the Pyrenees. And we're flying up the road, retracing the road. And I look down, I'm like, there's some damn sperm on the road. Somebody painted sperm, giant sperm, like the size of Volkswagen Beetles, right on the road. So there they were. So I had to put it in the film because they were really there.
So they're actually there.
So I couldn't wait to call Ben. I was like, hey, Ben, you remember I told you about the sperm? He goes, yeah, you crazy man. I was like, well, guess what? They're in the movie.
you just said your mother was helping with nutrition. Mm. What were you eating? What were you drinking? And what did you weigh when you started? What did you weigh when you finished?
Well, I actually went in fat on purpose. I went in with a little blubber on me because I knew that there was no way that we counted calories. And on that day, that death stage, our garments ran out at 15,000 calories for over those 23 hours. We were burning some calories. You can't eat those kind of calories, right? No. You can't eat enough. So we went, I went in a little fat and, I think I weighed I was about 172 pounds going in. And by the time I finished, I was about 163 pounds. I lost about 9 pounds, I think.
Man, that ain't bad.
It's not bad, and I'll tell you why. I mentioned my friend Eric Hillman, and he helped me with the nutrition. And Eric Hillman, he works for a company that sells nutritional products. So he knows a lot about nutritional products, and he's a judge for bodybuilding, and you know, he goes way back in the nutritional world. And he came up with this concoction, and it was protein powder, amino acids, cytocarb, a carbohydrate, and then an electrolyte. Two scoops of all of them into a big 2-liter bottle of water. Now, it was not easy to drink. It was like very powdery, but it wasn't about whether it was easy to drink. It was like, I got to get this in. And he said, every night, no matter how you feel, you got to drink this. So Ben and I forced this concoction into our bodies. And when I say forced, it was like to the point where we just thought we were going to throw up. So we would drink it over a couple of hours just to get it in our bodies. But here's the crazy thing. So the bottle was about that, as big as that. I don't know what that bottle is in front of you. 1.5
liter.
1.5 liter. So we had a 1.5 liter with 8 scoops of nutrition in that 1.5 liter. We'd shake it up, shake it up, shake it up, shake it up. And then sometimes it'd be so thick, I'd pour more water. Once I drank it down a wee bit, I'd pour more water on top of it, shake it up. We drank that every single night. And I'm telling you, you're the same age as me. I don't know how much you get up to pee in the middle of the night, but I got to get up to pee at least once. At least once.
Yeah.
Drinking that just before we went to bed, I never got up to pee once the whole trip. One day we forgot. We both forgot to drink that concoction. It was the one day that we got cramps.
Really?
It was like a wonder drug. I mean, it was, without that, I just don't know. And I have a photo of my legs taken after the death stage. I can send it to you, man. My legs have never been so ripped in all my life. I mean, I'll never be in that kind of shape again. Sinewy, ripped leg muscles from pushing this damn bike around France. But a big part of it was we were getting that replacement. And without that, I just don't know how our bodies would have held up.
But just as far as normal food, just normal food?
Normal food. You know what was so cool? Quiches, like French quiches, butter, fat. And the other thing you realize is how important fat is to endurance. You know, a lot of people talk about, oh, fat's so bad and all this. Well, actually, fat is, you know, they've done tests with endurance athletes running on carbohydrate and running with fat. And the fat, people having fat is a better fuel source for an endurance athlete.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about you know, go eating bad fats, but lots of olive oils, and we had a lot of butter, and these quiches, what was crazy was you could eat a quiche, let's say the quiche was 5-inch diameter quiche, beautiful quiche, real buttery, eggy, you know, with all the yolks and everything in it. You'd eat that thing, it would go in your body, it was like it didn't even touch the sides.
Right.
You could just feel your body go, just burn that thing up, and like, you could never eat enough. We could not eat enough.
So,
man, it was so cool eating whatever you wanted to.
When you guys finished completing the task, like what was the feeling? Was it anticlimactic, or was it
very
like
emotional?
A sense of accomplishment, okay. Emotional.
Yeah, I was quite emotional.
Well, what was the part of the race that kind of supercharged you? There's one part in that race you kind of found this renewed energy.
Yeah, that was when we went to Le Quesnoy. So Le Quesnoy was where my relative Reginald Hurd, he was a monster of a man. For the day, for 1918 and World War One, I believe he was around 6'3", and he was a powerhouse man, you know. And he went up over this rampart, up over this big wall. They went over and they fought the Germans and took them prisoner and liberated this town. And when I got to the town, and my dad was with me, my dad had lost his uncle in the Somme, in the Battle of the Somme, and he's buried in Arras. In a little French town called Arras. My dad got quite emotional. And then I got emotional. You know, when you're that physically tired, mentally tired, and then just the idea that my relatives were there and fighting in this war, and oh, crazy. I mean, no war is a good war. But just to think of him going over that wall, and it made what we were doing feel very trivial, and yet at the same time, I felt like, well, it's not war, it's not life or death, but it's an important story. It's important to celebrate achievement, and we're doing this for Harry. And so I just felt this renewed strength. And when I got back out on the road, man, I was charged. I was mentally like psyched up, like all my ancestors were with me, man. I was, you know, on the road, and that really charged me up. And I, at the end of it, getting to the end, as Ben said, it was pretty anticlimactic because it was not like we rode into, as they did in 1928, into the Parc des Princes where there's 10,000 people cheering. And not that we expected that or deserved that. It was just the idea that I guess we hadn't really thought about what would happen when we got to the end. When we got to the end, you know, it was just this little family gathering. We knew we were there where they had finished. But I was emotional. The reason I was emotional was I think in the back of my mind, I had this feeling that somehow I was going to find something. I was going to find maybe Harry Watson. And I think it was the realization that he was gone. I'd never get to speak to him and that I never caught them, you know, because I was telling you I've drifted in my mind. There were hours and hours that would go by where we would be riding where I was convinced we were going to catch them, you know. And then it was that realization, dude, it's like I got slapped in the face, like, dude, they're not here. They're gone. You're done. And it was just also a great sense of relief and a sense of just knowing that we had pushed ourselves right to the very edge. I'm so glad I know what that's like to go to the edge of right under the borders of pain and suffering. But a great sense of achievement as a team because it wouldn't have happened without everybody.
Did that for you make your in your mind or in your being make your level of toughness? Okay, I thought I redlined here when I did this, but hey, man, this is the toughest thing I've ever done, and this is where my tough meter's at.
Yeah,
but you're a guy. Before we get off the documentary, I love this documentary. It affected me so much. I'm going to follow the Tour de France from now on, and I'm following right now because it's going on.
Yeah.
And I always knew that it was a tough event, but watching what these guys went through, watching what you guys went through was just amazing.
Mm.
So it made me a fan of the event.
Well, you know, I never got baseball when I came to America. I didn't get it. I didn't understand it. But what I realized was that there's a culture in baseball, and there are these ardent fans, and I love American fans. I love how people in America pick a team and they stick with the team. And, you know, that whole thing that happened with the Cubs and how those fans, you know, grandfathers who have been fans from when they were little kids and they stuck with their team for decades and then had that amazing moment when the Cubs were in the limelight. So what I realized with a sport like baseball is you don't just look at the sport and go, well, okay, there's a guy throwing it and there's a guy trying to hit it and they're going from base to base. What you realize is it's a whole culture. It's the history of the sport. It's those people who came before and it's those people who are in it now who are going to become legends in their own right in the future. And cycling is the same way. From the outside, it appears there's a bunch of guys riding on a bicycle and that's not exciting. But when you understand it at a deep level and you realize all those people who have ridden over those climbs before and the history of what came before and what's at stake, it's this massive, it's like the difference between playing checkers and playing chess. The layers of chess and the complexities of chess, that's what the Tour de France is. And so the sacrifice that these team members are making for their team leader, the GC rider, that's the person that has a chance to win it overall. These people who are tearing themselves inside out physically with no hope in hell of ever winning the Tour themselves, but they are prepared to drop back from a peloton that's doing 30 miles an hour, drop back to a team car, load themselves up with pounds of bottles of water, force themselves, you know, force with all their effort them their way back, all the way back to the peloton to drop off bottles for the people, because they're domestiques, these riders, to drop off bottles for people, sacrifice everything, burn all their matches for their guys. When you understand it at that level, then you really, like, you really get into it. And so it is a wonderful sport, and I just love. I always dreamed of riding in the Tour de France when I was a kid. I never thought I'd be doing it at 46 or on an older bike. But just that I've experienced some part of the history of the Tour de France, you know, I just love that I'm now able to share that story with people and, you know, and maybe inspire people to do their own Tour de France or their own journey or their own something, whatever it is.
How do people see the movie?
Well, right now they can see it at on demand film. So if they go to my website, philcoganleride.com, you can see where it says demand film, and you can click on the map of America there, and or any of the countries that are flags that are listed, and you'll see where it's all screening. But I'm working with this company called Demand Film, where anybody in America can request a screening of the film in their local community with no risk. To say, hey, I want to have a screening in Eureka, California. They can put in a request, and then they can host their own screening. What I love about it is a film like this, which is not going to get a, you know, a release of Transformers or some big blockbuster movie, will be seen on a big screen. Because right. as I mentioned to you, we shot this in 4K, which is the equivalent of super 35 millimeter film, beautiful Angelo French lenses. It's, I want people to be able to get to see it on a big screen. So we have some screenings coming up in Boulder. There's a few here in California, in Fresno. We've got one in Dallas, San Diego. They're all over the country. And so we're going to continue to do that up until September. And then we're talking to a video on demand service, you know, maybe like a Netflix or an Amazon or one of them to distribute it digitally. But as many people as possible, I want them to be able to experience it on the big screen, because it's epic. You know, we've got these shots, these aerial shots flying over the Alps and the Pyrenees. We've tried to bring this story to life and get people connected with the romance of what is the Tour de France.
I was talking to my friend the other day, and I told him you were coming over. We've been talking about the Tour de France, and he had just gotten back from France. He'd been going every year for 35 years. Mm. I'm 52. I told him, I said, man, I'm talking to this guy, Phil Cogan. He just recreated 1928 Tour de France. You know, amazing race, all that. So he knew who you were. But anyway, he goes, oh, yeah. He goes, you've got to come with me and Mary next year when we go. I didn't know how beautiful France was.
Yep.
Jesus Christ. I mean, yep. just the footage that you guys got, the way you captured it, watching it, you know, like I said, in a theater experience would be amazing. Yep. It was spectacular. I was mad that I didn't know more about the Tour de France, and I was mad that I didn't realize how beautiful that country was.
Yeah, well, I would thoroughly recommend that you go over and follow a couple of stages. And, you know, the other thing you can do is you can actually ride. You could actually ride. You don't have to go do the crazy climbs. You're too big a guy, man. Besides, you probably break some bike.
But, I ain't riding
but
nothing.
You can ride even if you just do like a little portion of the through right. the countryside. There's so many great little rides, but just follow the tour. What's so nice is it, when you watch it, it is like a history. It's geography, it's travel, it's you see the passion of these people,
yeah.
and they will open their arms to you, man, and they'll know who you are, and they'll be like, man, look at this guy's come over to check out the Tour de France. But to go into these little French towns where, you know, they're all bidding to be the town that the Tour de France comes through, they open their doors to the world, and you'll sit down in some beautiful little cafe having a beautiful French quiche with a nice cup of coffee and watch the tour literally go right by, yeah. like right by you. I would recommend you go with your friend up into the mountains. What's nice about going in the mountains is they have to come up the mountain real slow.
Right.
But the mountains are spectacular. The Pyrenees Mountains are right on the border of Spain and France. I actually prefer the Pyrenees over the Alps. I think the Alps are stunning, but I love the Pyrenees. There's something very special about those little towns like Luchon. And Pau and all these different places that they go through. But, man, absolutely go and enjoy it. Sunflowers, summer, France.
How cool was it one time y'all were riding? I can't remember which mountain range it was, but then there were two ladies out there jogging beside you guys. I mean, you're riding at a snail's pace because it was a heck of a climb, and they were just dumping water on you.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, thank you. How was that?
Yeah, it was awesome. It was a little bit like, you know, what they do in the Tour de France, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know how these professionals make their way through the crowd sometimes. I mean, have you seen?
Yeah.
Like, it's like the parting of the sea. Some of these riders tell me that that when they're riding up these really steep climbs, they can't actually see the road. They just sort of aim for the middle of where the people are, and then they part, and then the road sort of unfolds. It's like a zipper just kind of opens up, and they make their way through. But it's scary. And then years ago, you would have seen a couple of times, what other sport do fans get that close to the players?
Right.
You know, back in the day, I mentioned this guy, Eddie Merckx. Back in the day, there was some fan that didn't like him, and he got punched in the kidney. That guy was tough, man, Eddie Merckx. Woo.
But that was, wait, you know, if they rode through and that particular crowd didn't like you or
yeah,
whatever, I mean, you might get the crap beat out of you.
Well,
seemingly, or get some shots.
Well,
or to throw in tacks and glass
or they get
wheels.
So close, and then you see these guys, they have a couple of beers up on the course, and they put on the Barat outfit, you know, with their tackle is hanging through there like a little bag of lollies and the thing is coming right up there where it's all just hanging out and they're running up the crazy idiots with their butt cheeks hanging and they're running up. But yeah, a couple of the riders over the years have had like bags or something caught on the handlebars as they're going up, and those crashes, they hurt. I think personally that the slower crashes hurt more than the really fast ones. With the fast ones, sometimes right. you slide. But the small ones, when you hit, you just like hit the ground. It can. Oof.
I don't want to give away the film, but you guys didn't have any flat tires.
Not one flat tire.
Back
Not
in the one. Day, say 28, or say now, what happens? Oh no, I will go back to 28 because that's what y'all were.
28. They
what could, happens when you had a flat tire? Did a team come and change it for you? Did you carry a spare? What
they
happened?
They were carrying the tires over their shoulder and tubes. Way back in the Tour de France, in the beginning. You had to do all your own repairs, too. Oh. Nobody could touch your bike. You would get disqualified. And the famous stories of people breaking their forks and stopping in a town and then welding the frame back together. But nobody could even help you. In fact, one guy got disqualified or got a penalty because he had someone pump the billows to help him weld his bike. That was a penalty. So, yeah, it's... but, yeah, the there were team cars... helping, but sometimes they would, you know, the riders would get so spread out over a 200-mile stage, it wasn't the same with the radio. Hey, listen, more, you know, now they even have neutral support. So if your team car isn't around, there's a neutral motorbike that has wheels on it, and they'll stop and they'll give you a bike of, a wheel of the same brand that you're using that's compatible with what you're doing. But yeah, they would get up to a dozen flat tires in a day. We didn't get one in 3,338 miles. Not Ben either. Neither one of us got a flat, which is remarkable. But the thing that blows my mind is as hard as it was for us, we were on sealed roads. Yeah. These guys, I don't know how, and you want to talk about why they got body sores, is because that dust get in the clothes and then it would just start to rub and they get these sores.
And that's one of the things I was going to ask you about, because there was some old footage. Was that like stock footage from 28?
Yeah. So we spent...
It was amazing.
We
because
spent
you saw
years
the actual
digging,
roads.
Yes. We spent years digging around to find that footage. Took a long, long time.
What
and the photos.
Bainbridge
yes.
dropped out, and he was 38 when the
I'm amazed at how much stuff you've remembered from the film. It's
I
cool.
I told you my internet's down, but I would normally... A
yeah, no, but I appreciate it.
But, no, so he ended up dropping out.
Yeah, so...
Beat to shreds, had a crash.
Yeah, so Bainbridge, cool
Body
story.
Body sores everywhere.
Yeah. Bainbridge was the oldest rider, 38 years old. What was interesting about him... Again, with this World War I connection, he was in France fighting 10 years before he was on the tour. Back in the
wow.
same part of France, he's riding through northern France where he was fighting the Germans only 10 years before. He comes back and he's 38 years old. He was a phenomenal rider, but he was sort of at the end of his career.
Right.
And he just wasn't up to hanging with these 24, 25-year-old riders like Opperman and Watson. Now... The guy Percy Osborne was a beast, man. He was the bull. He was much. He would have been probably a better rugby player than a cyclist, but he was still an amazing athlete. What's interesting about him was his brother was killed in northern France in World War I. So here he is riding in a bike race 10 years after his brother had been in France and lost his life. So there's a lot of emotion there for
right.
all of these guys because they're all connected, like I said, 10% of our population. So that's a huge part of, and that's why we paid tribute to World War I in the film, because you can't ignore the fact that this was a team that was coming there after World War I.
With the fact that they had no nutrition back in the day, with respect to the just the blisters and the yeah. sores, what do they call it? The rider's rash.
Yeah.
Or all that
road
stuff.
Rash
and, road rash.
And
what kind of salve or what were they using back in the day to try to alleviate some of the stuff? Because, I mean, Bainbridge was an extreme pain.
Yeah.
Just trying to pedal his bike.
So they have these saddle sores. I mean,
saddle sores.
And yeah, people get saddle sores even now. We had a state of Ben and I were wearing old woolen out. We were wearing woolen outfits, but they're retro, so they had really good chamois. The chamois is the pad that's inside the shorts, so they draw moisture away from your groin area, so that you don't sweat too much in the groin, and because it's the moisture and then the rubbing, the consistent moisture and rubbing that's what creates the saddle sores. And then in addition, there's also a chamois cream. So it's a cream that basically helps to keep your skin protected, kind of like what babies you put on babies to get them, stop them getting a diaper rash. So back in the day, they didn't have really amazing chamois or pads in the shorts. But the big issue was not only was the clothing really rudimentary, but now imagine you get dust on that pad, and then there's dust on the pad, it's seeping into the material. Now they're sweating, and then that is rubbing day after day after day after day, and then you get the saddle sore. The problem is you're never off the bike to let it heal. Once that thing gets on top of you, then it becomes septic. And so what happened to Bainbridge, he got body sores, not just in his groin, but also, you know, in his thighs, under his arms. And then once then the body is so depleted, they just wore these guys out. Like I said, well, what they were doing, 20,000 vertical feet in a day climbing. I mean, that's an insane amount of climbing.
That's what I wanted to ask you. What was the time posted by the winner in 1928 versus the time you guys posted from start to finish?
So the Victor Fontaine won the race won stage 9 in 18 hours and 30 minutes. We were riding for 23 hours and 30 minutes. Now, admittedly, we weren't racing. We were also stopping. We stopped on the side of the road, if you remember, to talk to Emil. But still, when we rode, we rode. I mean, we weren't mucking around. We were riding, you know, as best we could. But it's impossible to actually compare the times, too, because they were riding on unsealed roads. We had perfectly sealed roads. So how he rode that stage, 1830, look. In the modern Tour de France today, a long stage would be 6 hours. That would be monumental. Most stages, 3-4 hour stages. This tour in 1928 was 1,000 miles longer than the race is today. In fact, the race this year in 2017, if I'm not mistaken, is 1,200 miles less than it was in 1928.
Why is that?
I think it's a number of reasons. One is the television coverage. Can you imagine trying to cover the race for 18 and a half hours? They need to do it in daylight because they can't shoot in night. I think also just the satellite time and the wear and tear on the thing. And also I think the attention span of the audience. You know, they have a certain window of attention. I just think it'd be too much. And I think they've done an incredible job. I mean, I think they do it. This stage this year has really, I mean, they've programmed some short, sharp, punchy stages. And, man, we've got a real battle on our hands, and it's really exciting.
You know, your documentary has really made me a fan of the Tour de France. And once again, Phil's documentary is called Le Ride, and you can get it on demand at his website, philcoganleride.com. All right, need to take care of the sponsors to make this show possible. But after that, I want to talk with Phil about the amazing race and bungee jumping. But like I said, let's pay some bills first. So thanks to TrueCar. If you're looking to buy a new or used vehicle, you need to download the TrueCar app. TrueCar gives you the price and information you need to feel confident about your vehicle purchase. When you register with TrueCar, you'll see what other people in your local area paid for the car you want. And from there, you can connect with a local TrueCar certified dealer and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. TrueCar shows you real pricing on actual inventory, so you see competitive pricing offered to you by TrueCar certified dealers for vehicles that are actually on their lots. And you'll also see all the dealer incentives before you get to the lot, so you feel confident about the price when you show up. TrueCar makes car buying easy, no matter if you're looking for a brand new or used vehicle. And the stats don't lie. Over 3 million cars have been sold to True Car users by the True Car Certified Dealer Network. There are over 13,000 dealers in that network with some 700,000 pre-owned vehicles available. So do yourself a favor and go to True Car for your next car buying experience. True Car doesn't just make the process easier, it'll also save you some money. True Car users save an average of over $3,000 off MSRP. So when you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit True Car to enjoy a better car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
Hey, can I ask you a couple of questions before you have to haul us out of here?
Yeah.
Hey, tell me about the No Opportunity Wasted, because it all came out of a swimming accident when you were 19 years old.
Yeah.
And y'all were ship diving.
Yeah.
Or diving, and you went to a ship underneath the water.
Yeah.
And you and your dive partner kind of got separated, and I guess you had a panic attack. But at 19, that kind of changed the way you were thinking about your life. And 19 is a really young
pivotal age for
someone to have a life-changing experience.
Yeah.
But No Opportunity Wasted came from that experience.
Came from that, yeah.
Can you tell that story?
Sure. So my first hosting job I got when I was 19. I started in television at 18, being a film camera assistant. I wanted to be a shooter. That was the first thing. And then I had an opportunity to go in front of the camera. And one of my first assignments was to go dive on a shipwreck. And it was very deep. And I'm a diver. I grew up in the Caribbean, so I grew up diving. I love the water. But I'm very claustrophobic. But at 19, I thought it would be kind of unmanly to tell all the guys, these big burly divers, hey, I'm scared to go into tight places. And, you know, so I didn't say anything. And I'd never been inside a shipwreck. And it was 120 feet down underwater, which is quite deep for a diver. And you suck a lot of air. The deeper you go, the more air you use up because of the pressures. You soak up more, use up more oxygen. And so the idea was that we were meant to go down. I was meant to go down with a camera operator ahead of a group of divers who were going to come in from another entrance, and we were going to meet in a huge ballroom. The ship was on its starboard side, so imagine this whole room tilted over. And the reason we were going in from different entrances is because there's silt in there, and if you move around with your flippers and there's too many people, it silts up, you can't see anything. And I knew that's why we were doing it, because we wanted nice, clean pictures. We went down into a ballroom, and we were waiting for the crew. And I was doing okay. I was with the guy, and I felt like I was under control. And then the crew didn't turn up. And I'm 120 feet down, and I'm very conscious of my breathing. And then this guy left me to go find the crew. But I panicked and didn't know why he'd left me. And then I realized I didn't know where I was. I didn't know how to get out. I was really deep. I was sucking air. And I started to panic to the point where I started beating the valve on the regulator. So I was sucking in water. And I don't remember how or when this guy came back or how I got to the surface. But I do remember being on the boat and, again, not wanting to share my panic, but I think the diver knew. He must have seen the look in my eye. And I remember looking up at this beautiful blue sky and realizing, man, I'm out of there. I got out of that. And then realizing, oh, my God, I could have died. When you're 19, you never think you're going to die. You're going to live forever.
Right.
So that was wake-up call time. And I couldn't wait to get a piece of paper and a pen. And I wrote down everything I wanted to do. I hadn't been with many girls at that point, so there were a few things with girls on there on that list. I ticked a few of those off.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a pretty selfish list because I was 19. But that was really the embryonic stages of this philosophy, this personal philosophy, no opportunity wasted, write a list of things to do before you die. And that really has been the impetus of my entire career. So this ride around France, a ride across America. You know, I had a goal to raise $1 million for a charity in my life. All of these goals have been achieved, and I've been focused on these things because of that experience at 19. It was a wake-up call. So I do a lot of motivational speaking and mentor a number of people, and that's where I get them to go to, is like, hey, sit down, think about what you would regret most if you were to die at 3 o'clock tomorrow, All right. Now you got that in your mind. What would you most regret not doing? And start focusing on those things. Write them down and go, okay, why am I not doing them? So, yeah, I wrote a book in 2004 called No Opportunity Wasted. And, you know, in hindsight now, I'm glad it happened to me. Crazily enough.
Yeah, but at the time.
Oh, man. No way. Yeah.
Hey, a quick question about hosting reality television.
Yeah.
The Amazing Race has been around since 2000, 2001.
Yep.
Yeah, because you started in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
You auditioned to be the host of
Survivor.
Survivor.
Yep.
And then they got Jeff Probst.
Yep.
But obviously they were impressed with you, and they said, hey, man, we want you to do
I found out I was up for a couple of shows. I was also up, I heard, for that Guinness Book of World Records mm-hmm. show. There was a few shows going on at that point, but yeah. All those years ago.
But I guess my question is, what is the audition process for hosting a show that's as big as Amazing Race or Survivor? What's the process?
There was no audition for either Jeff or I for those jobs, okay. actually. But both of us had a number of years of experience. Jeff and I actually worked together at FX when FX first started back in 1994. So both of us came with a track record of doing television. I think the work, you know, speaks for itself. It's one of those things where it's hard to, it's not like the role, acting a role, like here's the material, what can you do with the material? How do you depict this? How would you play this character? With hosting, it's really about, these are the shows, they're looking for you, you know, they want you. Like your persona on Broken Skull Ranch, I mean, all your little sayings, all your little things. It's like, hey, man, this is me. This is what I am. And people know. They watch you. That's you. I mean, and you're the same. Like the thing I loved about meeting you was you're the same guy on the air and off the air. I mean, you bring that authenticity. So that is hard for a lot of people, by the way. A lot of actors struggle with that. A lot of people struggle with that authenticity. So I think to answer your question, people can either see that there's an authentic aspect to what it is you do as a host, like there's a natural ability to be able to own material and to run with it. Nobody knew that Survivor or Amazing Race was going to become the big shows that they became. They both could have been shows that just ran for one season and it would have been, you know, it would have come and gone. I mean, had I got the Guinness Book of World Records, I think it ran for like three seasons and I would have been on a totally different path because that came up before Race.
Right.
Somebody else would have done Amazing Race. So a lot of it has to do with timing, but I think the reason there was a lot of interviewing, by the way. There wasn't auditions, but there was right, a lot okay. of interviewing. But they look at the body of your work and they look at your experience and then they meet you in person and then they think, is this person suited to this job? Can they carry this? Can they hold this? You know, and I think there's a lot of good hosts. I just don't think that there's a lot of hosts that have real X factor quality. Like, you know, Kelly on Kelly, right now it's Ryan and Kelly. She has an X factor, some connection that she has with an audience. You know, obviously going back in the day to Carson, you know, there are certain people that just resonate with something extra. And I think it's hard to be authentic. I think people underestimate how hard that is to bring that. But, you know, I'm paying you a compliment. I think you bring that, and that's why I think people like it, because it's like no but bullshit, that, you know.
But my show, or Broken Skull, is on a much smaller scale.
Yeah,
but you carry the show. But let me ask you this. Mm. An Amazing Race, and just reading about the casting and how the show is strategically planned,
yeah.
All the visas are attained, and just the casting and everything that you've got to do, you're getting there before everybody gets there. When you guys go to shoot that, how many shoot days or months does that entail?
Well,
how much of a year does it take up is what I'm asking.
Yeah, it's a good 6 months when we do a season, right? But I just want to be really clear about, you know, the show. It's so much about a collaboration of so many people. That's why Amazing Race works. Starts with a vision, starts with a great idea. It was actually a woman by the name, the executive producer, Elise Doganieri, who came up with the original idea, who then shared it with her husband, Bertram. And then together they developed this idea. And at the time that they were developing the idea, there were actually three other race around the world type shows that were being pitched in the space. I, believe it or not, had an interview with one of the other shows before I was considered for Amazing Race. It was being done by another company. And they were, the working title was loosely based around A Race Around the World in 80 Days. I really believe in the universe. Sometimes there's things that become part of the zeitgeist, like your show, Ninja Warrior, and then a whole lot of other shows started to spring up. And as I mentioned to you, I've been developing a show in this space since 2006. But sometimes, you know, like one thing takes off and then a whole bunch of whatever. It's like right. The universe all goes to the same place. That was kind of happening with Amazing Race. So starts with an amazing idea. As with any great or amazing idea, the idea is one thing, but then you got to go execute it. You think about, you know, you think about your show. You throw somebody else into that, your show. It becomes a different show when somebody else is hosting it. And then if you don't have the right team around you, the execution of what you guys do, because I love the way you guys use slow-mos and that sort of thing. There's a way that you guys make the show, and that's the execution that makes the show work. But there's so many different ways to skin the cat, right? Like, why'd you choose that the ranch that you chose? Why'd you choose that look, your tone and the way that the show would? So getting all of those things together to work, that path, if you like, to an idea to, okay, we got something really good here, where you're going into the unknown, because it's that whole thing I was saying to you before, new and different, susceptible to market research. You're doing a lot of guessing. We think the audience will like this. We think they'll like that. We think they'll like this. And then when you get there and you realize, okay, we got something that people really like, then maintaining that standard and then pushing the envelope, like trying new and different things, that's the hard part. So I'm a small cog in a wheel of a big machine. Now I'm the lucky guy who gets to go out and host the show, but my contribution to the show, or the value of what I feel I bring to the show, is more than, it is not so much what I do on screen. I've become the face of the show. But it's really more the preparation that I'm doing before I get out there, and then writing the scripts and doing the research and owning the material that somebody else has, you know, done the hard work on. They're going to scout that material and put all that material together. And so all these different layers. But ultimately, when I end up in front of the camera, what I do and the ability for me to be able to do my job well has been determined months in advance by every little step that happened to that point where we go. Right. And then once we shoot 12 shows in 21 days, brutal schedule.
Ain't kidding.
By the time we shoot it and it's all on tape, then there's this other part of, okay, we got all this material. Now we got to condense all of that down to 44 minutes. And then that becomes another layer. Those are other layers of decisions that determine the ultimate, the result of what we get in the end. But if you work backwards from those 44 minutes and you go, and you would do a timeline back through the 21 days of shooting in the post-production and then back into the research and then back to the original ideas, and you work all the way back, you realize the strength of that end product has been determined all the way along, all those decisions, all those people that have touched it, that have thrown something into it. Because 44 minutes, man, that's not long. And that's all we got to try to get an audience to go, wow. It's a lot to be condensed, crushed down into 44 minutes.
So you're still signed on that show for several more years.
Yeah, well, I we just got picked up for season 30.
Yep.
And I hope I... You know, that as long as the show keeps going, that they still want me to do it. I haven't lost any enthusiasm for it. It goes back to my philosophy of no opportunity wasted, where I've been helping people live their full lives. And so I see that on Amazing Race. And yeah, I love, my thing is all about people. That's why I got into hosting. I love people. I love facilitating people. My job is to, if I go in camera with somebody, how do I make somebody look good? You know, I want to facilitate them. I make them look good. It makes me look good. The better I am at making them look good, the better I am at my job. So I just finished a series for, a special for Smithsonian Channel. It's called Flying High. And I piloted it in New Zealand. And it's going to be on August 6th on Smithsonian Channel. And it goes back to all my years of interviewing really interesting people. So I went to New Zealand and I interviewed about a dozen people that I thought were really interesting. Peter Jackson. And I went and looked at his World War I plane collection. Sam Neill, who was in Jurassic Park and he was in Peaky Blinders. He's been an amazing actor, Hollywood actor. But he has a vineyard. So I went and talked to him on his vineyard and talked about Pinot Noir. My dad, who's been on Amazing Race, who was a greeter on season 13, and walked around a garden with my dad. He's a plant scientist. Some top comedians in New Zealand. A farmer in New Zealand who uses a drone to round sheep up. You got to see this. I mean, the guy is so cool. You'll love the guy. Salt of the earth. And I was in my element because I was able to draw on my 30 years of being in television and use all those skills that I've learned over 30 years and facilitate and interview these people and make them shine, you know, make them the stars. And so that's what I would like to do more of going forward is highlighting cool people. That's the thing that gets me going, and that's why I still love being a part of Amazing Race, because we get to do that on the show.
Well, then finally, what is on your list of things that you still want to do? Because I guess you had dinner on a
volcano.
Erupting volcano. You and your wife replace your vows
underwater
in front of sharks, or were you feeding sharks?
Where the sharks turned up, we got a scuba diving priest, and we were expecting some dolphins, but then some sharks turned up. Yeah.
How hard is it to find a scuba diving priest?
That was hard because back when we did it in 1998, that we couldn't go online to search for a scuba diving priest. But he got down there with the good book, and he renewed our vows. And Banana George, I don't know if you've ever heard of Banana George. Do you remember the man in yellow, the Chiquita Banana Man? He was the older guy. Oh, my God. If he was alive, he would have been perfect for your podcast. You would have loved this guy. I've just written I was just interviewed for a book about him. You'll look him up. This guy was an accountant. He started water skiing in his 40s. He was in the Water Skiing Hall of Fame in his 60s, took up snowboarding in his 80s. I met him. He taught me how to barefoot water ski in 45 minutes. Not because I'm a good athlete, but because this guy's an amazing teacher.
Yeah.
Man, he lived in yellow. He was all in yellow. Anyway, he was my best man at the renewing of my vows. I broke a world record with a friend of mine who created commercial bungee jumping. 9 of us jumped off a bridge at one time. Unofficial world record because you have to go through the whole thing in rigmarole in England, so we just decided we'd do it. Dived the world's longest underwater caves. I swam across the Bosphorus from Asia to Europe. So in my life, I've been lucky enough to tick off some pretty crazy things. But now that I just turned 50, my list is a lot more about trying to do things for other people. I think just as you get older, you think, you know. But that said, I still have a lot of things on my list. I always wanted to climb Mount Everest. I have no desire to do that anymore. I see that as a very selfish thing now. All the trash has been left up there. I just think they've not treated the mountain. People are not treating it with respect. People are going in with, I don't know. I have strong feelings about that. I would love to go to the moon or at least go to space in my life. That would be kind of cool. But I live my life open, so if you got any ideas, throw them out because I'll do them.
Okay, last two questions. When you decided to repledge your vows with your wife down with the sharks,
yeah,
was it your idea or her idea?
It was. I don't know where that came from. Actually, it might have come from my old business partner. I had a great business partner. His name was Peter Faman. He directed the movie Crocodile Dundee.
Love that movie.
He took a chance on me when one of my first jobs in America. I think it might have come from him. We formed a company. We did a show called Adventure Crazy, and that was based on my life list. So it might have been, I think he might have come up with that idea.
So your wife was down with
it. Oh, listen, my wife, she's tough. Yeah, she's up for anything.
Okay,
so.
Tell me about the bungee jumping war record, because you said that was nine people together.
Yeah, so
together.
We actually broke it twice. The first time we did it was in 1998, and one of my very first jobs was I was a camera assistant, and I was working on a shoot. And there was a guy called Henry Van Ash, and he was New Zealand downhill and New Zealand downhill skiing and New Zealand downhill mountain biking champion. And we just hit it off. We just like became great friends. Right. And I just loved this guy because he lived in a Volkswagen van. I think he was maybe smoking a little too much dope. And and I just loved his attitude. Yeah. He was just carefree. Anyway, one of his friends went to the Eiffel Tower, jumped off the Eiffel Tower illegally, got arrested, but he was trying to impress this model. That was AJ Hackett. And Henry and AJ were good friends. Anyway, they formed this company, AJ Hackett Bungee. They created the first commercial bungee operation in the world in 1988. I think they opened it in 1988, if I'm not mistaken. It might have been 89. And I was one of the first people to jump. When people said you were crazy, what are you doing? You're tying yourself to a rubber band and jumping off a bridge. So over the years, I've kept in contact with Henry. Henry doesn't live in a Volkswagen van anymore. He has his own vineyard. He's very wealthy. Has a lovely home, a lovely wife and kids, and settled down. Like, he's living a life like I never expected him to live. And anyway, I was doing a shoot in New Zealand. I did a show, Adventure Crazy Show, in Queenstown. And I said to Henry, we got to go do something cool. And he said, well, how about we break a world record? So I said, all right. So the Cowrow Bridge, which is where I first jumped and where commercial bungee jumping first started, which is just outside Queenstown, he goes, why don't we get eight of us and we'll jump off the bridge at the same time? I was like, really? He goes, yeah, well, I'm jumping. He says, trust me, I own the company. I want to live, and so I wouldn't be doing this unless I felt it was safe. So eight of us jumped off the bridge at one time, and it was an unofficial world record, eight people at one time. So then years later, I was doing another shoot. I was going to Queenstown, and he said, hey, man, you want to go break that record again? I said, sure. He said, let's do nine. So we went back, and we did nine.
What is the feeling? Were y'all all strapped together, or is just nine people jumping simultaneously at different cords?
Yeah, so we had, I think, three people on each cord, and we had a number of cords, so it might have been three cords, might have been four, but yeah, all together, and then we all squeezed onto this platform, which is built for maybe two people, and we squeezed onto this thing, and then I was holding a camera in my hand, and so we all had our arms around each other, except I didn't have this arm to use to hold on. I was holding the camera, so we separated, and that was crazy. I got this really cool shot of us going down.
At one point, are you thinking like a Chevy Chase and Vacation? This is crazy.
Yeah.
What's the testing procedure? I don't drag this out, but what's the testing protocol for nine human beings, X amount of body weight, and deciding, okay, these are the bungees that we need?
The testing is nine people with bungees leaping off the bridge. That's the test. I mean, there's no way to truly test it.
Do you do it with, let's just say there's nine of you and you average 160 pounds each, okay, nine times 160, and then drop off a bunch of weight.
It's all a science, and it's all a science, and yeah.
You seem like a very intelligent human being.
Yeah, I'm reasonably bright, but I don't know if everybody would agree with that, but I certainly believe me, I thought, okay, well, if Henry's doing it, then I got to be good. Sorry, you know what I mean? If the owner of the company is prepared to strap himself to this cord right now, then I'm good with it. But I like doing things that are, you know, I spent 3 days in a nudist resort once.
In a what?
In a nudist resort, naturalist resort, when I pitched, I remember pitching the show to Discovery. We called the show Nude Awakenings. And this was 1998. And Discovery were like, you're going to what? I was like, well, this couple's getting married in the nude, and they want me to come along. And if I'm going to be part of the congregation, I'm going to be in the nude. And I said, that's an adventure. And they were like, well, how's that an adventure? Because they think adventure, they think mountains, bungee jumping, climbing, leaping, jumping, all this stuff. And I go, but again, to the mental thing, Adventure is anytime you're doing anything where you're outside your comfort zone. So it took me 5 months to convince them. It was one of the first shows that we pitched them before they finally agreed that we could do an episode there. Called it Nude Awakenings. We go along. I go to the wedding. It was before Austin Powers, that where they had the cover everything covered up. So we do an interview with people, and we put two wine glasses right in front of the nipples of the person that we were interviewing, or the waiter would come past. He'd have a tray with a big long bread roll, and they did nude volleyball playing and all this crazy stuff. Anyway, I opened my eyes up because I had no idea what people could do with pubic hair, and I saw things I'd never want to see again. Just like way too much. Anyway, we get to the end of the wedding, and this is a wonderful ceremony, and then the couple get a gift from an artist who says that they could have any part of their body molded, and they lie on a massage table, and then this guy molds any part of their body. So they decide they want to have their glutes molded, their glutamus maximuses. Your butt. So I'm like, oh, okay. So we're going to film that. Well, before they go out on the massage table, they go, hey, Phil, you want to join us? And I was like, and then they go, no opportunity wasted. So what do you say now? It's like, that's my mantra, man. I gotta be no opportunity wasted. So I'm, okay. So Steve, you know, you're alive when you're lying on a massage table and you turn around and there's a guy coming at you with baby oil, saran wrap, and a spatula. And you, like, everything, like, in that moment, I look and I'm thinking, okay, I know where this is going. Saran wrap, spatula, baby oil, then molds my ass. So 6 weeks later, my ass arrives in the mail. But I hadn't told my wife. I totally forgot about it. And my wife...
That's a good thing to forget about.
My wife opens a box and she sees this molding of my ass. She recognizes it straight away. And she goes, why is there a molding of your ass here at the door? And I said, because I had... And she goes, what are you talking about? So anyway, my wife has a good sense of humor. She turned it into a salad bowl. And the first dinner party we had... She tosses the salad. All right, that's the end of that.
In another movie, when he walked out with the spatula, the flower, and whatever you said, in Pulp Fiction, break out the gimp.
Yeah.
He's asleep. Pick him up. We got to close it on that high spot. Phil, awesome talking to you.
You too.
I might break this down into two podcasts. One more time, where can people watch the movie, The Ride, La Ride?
Okay, so La Ride is available at us.demand.film. It's screening all over the country until September. You can also go to my website, which is philcoganlaride.com. My name has got a funky spelling, but I'm sure you'll find it. philcoganlaride.com. Right there, you'll see all the information. And then look out for the Smithsonian Project, August the 6th. If you want to meet some great New Zealand characters, August the 6th on the Smithsonian Channel. It's fun. Peter Jackson, Sam Neill, my dad, a guy who rounds up sheep with a drone. It's got the whole gamut. My favorite takeaway food in New Zealand, which is some crayfish, and a chance to see New Zealand and meet the people of New Zealand.
I'm in. Last question. Are you on Twitter or Instagram?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. It's mainly what I use, at Phil Cogan, KEOGHAN. And on Instagram, I'm the Filiminator. They call me the Filiminator because I eliminate people on Amazing Race. I'm just the Filiminator.
Awesome. Hey, man, good talking to you.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you. And listen, congratulations on your show. I really enjoy watching it. And great to meet you. Really good to meet you.
Thank you, man. All right, I want to thank Phil Cogan of The Amazing Race for coming by 317 Gimmick Street today and talking about his documentary, La Ride, where they recreated the 1928 Tour de France. It's absolutely awesome, and I really enjoyed the hell out of it. It changed life for me because I'm going to be staying on top of the Tour de France from here on out. I suggest you guys check it out. And I tell you what, since you're giving me the go-home cue, that means it's time for my video of the week. And I'm going to suggest the same thing I did last Tuesday when Phil was on the show. I'm going to tell you guys to go check out Phil's documentary, LaRide. You can get it on demand at philcoganlaride.com. The website gives you all the 411 on how to see it in theaters. All right, I got a couple of quick plugs before we wrap things up. If you want to check me out on social media, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at SteveAustinBSR. I got some badass t-shirts for this season's Broken Skull Challenge, and you can find them coming up soon at ProWrestlingTees.com/SteveAustin. It's hotter than hell out there. If you're thirsty and you want the best IPA on the planet, get the Broken Skull IPA from El Segundo Brewing Company. Stop by the brewery if you are in L.A. Pick it up at Whole Foods and Total Wines if you live in Cali, or order it from InsideTheCellar.com if you live in a state they ship to. And I got one more thing to tell y'all about. I got my own Amazon store, and that's where you can find the Cold Steel Broken Skull Knife and the new Working Man's Knife. Just go to Amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin. And thanks for supporting all the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show. That's how I'm able to do this podcast for you twice a week for free. And you can find all my sponsors at podcast1.com. Just click on the Killer Deals button at the top of the page and then click on the Steve Austin Show banner. Coming up on Thursday's Unleashed Show, we're running more of your phone calls than we took a few weeks ago. I promised we'd get to them, and we are. Big thank you to everyone who called in a few weeks back. It was fun to talk pro wrestling with y'all, and I look forward to doing it again. So coming up on Thursday, more of your phone calls. Hey, folks, the 60-second AP News headlines are coming up next. Until then, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
Thanks for listening to The Steve Austin Show. Check out new episodes every Tuesday on the Podcast One app, or subscribe at Apple Podcasts or PodcastOne.com.